We're continuing in our summer sermon series this morning, and today we're looking at isms. And the list of anti-Christian isms is almost endless. We could talk about Marxism, feminism, secular humanism, existentialism, empiricism, rationalism, relativism, postmodernism, deconstructionism, pluralism, inclusivism, ecumenism, and a whole bunch more. So I could have a sermon with about 50 points, I suppose, if we decided to explain every one of these. The world is simply filled with ideas that contradict the Christian faith. There are multiple threats to Christian doctrine and practice, and of course we can't talk about all of them, but we can talk about some of the most significantly contradictory and most dangerous threats to the church that are categorized under some of these isms. And so this morning, that's what I'll be doing, looking at some of these clear and present dangers that are described as isms. Particularly, we'll look at this morning atheism, secular humanism, pluralism, and postmodernism. Now, these are fairly large words or terms, I suppose, but the ideas behind them are fairly easy to understand. They're definitely contradictory. They're definitely unbiblical and unchristian, anti-Christian. And so they pose a real threat to us, and we should understand them because they're very influential. They are part of our culture. They're being promoted within our culture. Many, many people subscribe to them, and they are a threat to the Christian worldview and really the Christian church. So it's good for us not only to understand them, but also have some tools that we'd be prepared to show why they're wrong, at least to understand why they're biblically a threat. Remember that each of these isms represent a set of ideas. And as I've said before, and as I'm sure you know, ideas have consequences. There are results of these isms, and as I said, they threaten the church. They threaten Christianity, or at least they oppose Christianity. The ideas that we'll be considering today have had and continue to have a major influence on the way that people think and behave in our world today. So we should be aware of these things, and we should be on guard against them. When we hear people saying various things, it should sort of ring a bell if we've looked at these isms, and we should be able to say, oh, this person is speaking from an atheistic point of view, or this person is speaking from a postmodern point of view. I've heard about that, and now I see how this person is relating that idea or that philosophy. So let's look at these various isms and see why each one is a threat to the church. First of all, we'll start with atheism. Atheism, of course, is the belief that there is no God. As it says in Psalm 14, verse 1, the fool has said in his heart, what does the fool say? There is no God. And so this is an idea that goes way back to primitive times, people who say there is no God. Atheism is an open and positive denial of the idea that there is a God. Now, some people would say, I'm not sure. This is what we typically call an agnostic. I'm not sure if God exists or not. Atheists are sure, or at least they claim to be sure. Now, biblically speaking, are there any true atheists? No, the Bible says that God has revealed himself to every person. Everybody knows deep down inside that there is a God. That's a biblical statement. However, there are people who deny it. There are people who are self-deceived, who have convinced themselves that there must not be a God. But in reality, from a biblical point of view, we can argue very strongly that everybody is made in the image of God. Everybody has the proofs of God's existence. And God will hold them accountable for the fact that they have denied the God who made them. But there are those who claim that there is no God. We call them atheists. From what we see in the media, we might think that atheists are all over the place, that there must be, you know, 50% of people today who are atheists. But around the world, what would be the percentage? What is the, how many people today out of 100 would be atheist? It's probably well under 10% worldwide. Now, in some Western countries, the amount might be more, but worldwide we're talking far less than 10% of the population. So that means far more than 90, probably more than 90% of the population believes in some kind of a God, not necessarily the Christian or biblical God of the Bible, but at least they believe in some sort of God. So really atheism is a very minority opinion. And there are two basic kinds, or I guess we could talk about different categories of atheism. Some atheists, we might say, are absolute atheists. That is, they absolutely deny the existence of God. They are sure in their own mind that God does not exist. That's a small number of people overall. But then we could talk about practical atheists. And practical atheists may not exactly deny the existence of God. They simply live as if God does not exist. As it says in Titus 1:16, they profess that they know God, but in their works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work reprobate. So there are even religious people, people who may say that they believe in God, but they live as if God does not exist. God doesn't really make much of a difference to them. Perhaps they go to church on Sunday, perhaps they pray occasionally or read the Bible occasionally, but most of the time, you know, 90% of their waking hours, they don't think about God at all. They don't make choices based on the existence of God. As it says in Psalm 10, verse 4, the wicked will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. God is not in all his thoughts. Well, one of the marks of a Christian is that he brings all his thoughts into the captivity or under the lordship of Christ. All our thoughts are submitted to Christ. That's one of the things that we strive to do as a Christian. But an atheist, or at least a practical atheist, he doesn't think about God in his thoughts much at all. Occasionally, perhaps, he thinks some religious things, maybe while he's at church, but probably not even at church is his mind really devoted to the things of God. So the practical atheist is simply somebody who does not consider God in his everyday behavior. And you know what? Even professing Christians can live like practical atheists. That is, they don't consider God in their thoughts or in their choices or in their morality. They just kind of do whatever they feel like doing, or they do what the crowd is doing, or they do what seems to be the right thing or seems to be a good choice, but they're really not submitting themselves to God. They're not saying, if it's God's will, I will do this, that, or the other thing. They're just making their choices based on their own feelings or their own thoughts. So I think that's a thing that we need to be careful of. We might say, well, I'm not an atheist. I believe in God. But as the psalmist says, perhaps you might be guilty of this, that God is not in all your thoughts. You don't submit yourself, your thoughts, your beliefs, your morality. You're not submitting that to God. And so you're acting potentially like a practical atheist, even though you believe that God exists. Well, atheism is a threat to the church because the idea that God does not exist is becoming more influential. As I said, this is well under 10% of the population, but some of the most influential people are atheists. They're making films, they're writing books, they're writing magazine articles. There's all sorts of things in our world today that is promoting the idea of atheism. And not only that, they're hard at work trying to rid the culture of the last vestiges of Christianity. They want to erase all Christian influence from the public square. They want to remove the motto, "In God We Trust," from off of our public buildings and off of our money. They want to remove "Under God" from the Pledge of Allegiance. They want to remove the Ten Commandments, setups. They want to remove any crosses from public land. They even want to remove the cross from public symbols. I forget what town it is. There's some town out in California where on the symbol, on the flag of this state or maybe the city, there's a church or something like that with a cross, and it has been the graphical design for that city for many, many years. And there's an effort, and I think they've been successful, in removing that cross from off of the symbol of the city. So this is what the atheists are trying to do, is to remove all vestiges of Christian influence from the culture. It's not so much that they're trying to shut down churches, but they certainly are trying to shut down the Christian influence within our culture. Well, ideas have consequences, and atheism is no exception. Under atheism, there really are no moral standards of behavior. Since there's no God, morality then must come simply from the society. It's just the population saying, well, here's what we agree with, here's what we disagree with. It's kind of the general consensus, and the society makes up the moral guidelines as it goes along. So morals then are nothing more than what the people want them to be. So they're flexible and constantly changing. Sure, 50 years ago we had this set of morals. Now we have a totally different set of morals, but that's okay because morals just come from the population. And whatever the population decides, that's what we're going to do. There's no absolute moral guidelines. It's all pretty much a matter of, well, what do we think today? So things can change. Things are very flexible. I was watching a video just a few weeks ago of where an atheist was criticizing a Bible believer over the institution of slavery. And so the atheist was saying, how can you believe the Bible when the Bible allowed slavery, the ownership of one person by another? How is it that you can defend the idea of one person owning another? Isn't that immoral? Well, how can an atheist have any kind of moral ideas whatsoever? Morality doesn't fit for an atheist. There's no moral guidelines, really, for an atheist because there's no lawgiver, there's no God, there's no absolutes. So who's to say that it's wrong for one person to own another person? Under atheism, there's no moral guidance whatsoever. So they really don't have the category, frankly, under atheism. There is no moral category where you could say something is wrong or something is evil. They don't have that. Under atheism, the world or the universe is essentially meaningless. Not only is there no morality, there's no meaning to the world. It all came out of nothing, and it's all going nowhere. Here's a quote from Richard Dawkins. He's a very famous, leading atheist. He put it this way. The universe we observe has precisely the properties that we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. No evil, no good, just blind, pitiless indifference. That's the universe in which we live, according to Richard Dawkins. So how can you say, then, that life has purpose or meaning? How can you say that any action is moral or immoral? With blind, pitiless indifference, no evil and no good, what does that mean that we are? Well, we're just a cosmic accident. We're just a bunch of, as one atheist put, a bunch of stardust. Isn't that wonderful? We're all just a bunch of stardust. We're packages of stardust basically banging into one another. We are molecules kind of fizzing, but that's all we are. We're just a bunch of animals. There can be no morality. There can be no true sense of right or wrong for pitiless, blind indifference. So atheism represents a threat to the church because atheists actively deny the claims of the Bible. Atheists obviously deny that God exists, they deny morality, they deny all sorts of things that Christianity stands for, and they're also trying to recruit believers, professing believers. Atheists are not happy just to not believe in God for themselves. They are almost evangelistic in trying to recruit people to their point of view. And unfortunately, they are enjoying a good deal of success and influence in our world. So we have to be careful. We have to be aware that there are many atheists and much atheistic influence in our world today. Then we can go on to secular humanism. Another ism is secular humanism. And this is largely based on the idea of atheism. Atheism, I think, naturally leads to secular humanism. Secular, of course, means without reference to God. When we talk about something being sacred, we mean that it has orientation or it has a connection with God. Secular means no connection, no orientation toward God. No religion, no sacred scripture. And then it's humanism. Now, humanism is this idea that we should do what is best for humanity. Secular humanists are not out to destroy humanity. They may be out to destroy the church because they don't believe in the church or Christianity or religion in general. But they're really striving for a better world. They're trying to reform things, make them better. They talk a lot about the overall good or the good for the most people, the greater good. But their goals and their methods exclude God. So it's secular. It's a focus on humanity, doing what's good for humanity, but without a religious reference. Secular humanism is a very influential point of view in our culture. Somebody said that humanists have come to dominate our universities, our schools, our press, newspapers, television, radio. The thought, the very vocabulary of this republic have fallen under the domination of humanist ideology. So we see this everywhere. All the people who are, today I think we might politically call them progressive. They're trying to make progress in the world. They're trying to move things in what they think of as a positive direction. These are people who might be called humanists. Humanists have published a statement of their values called the Humanist Manifesto. This was originally published way back in 1933. It's been updated a couple of times since then. But today they say that we should reject the ancient superstitions of the past and embrace the unquestionable results of modern science and philosophy. There's no good reason to retain the old religion, so it has to go. We have to throw the old Bible out the door, get rid of Christianity. These are superstitions. And so we've gone beyond that. We now live in the modern world. We're beyond the old superstitions. We don't need God anymore. We can explain everything through evolution, through science, through philosophy. We don't need God anymore as the creator. We have the Big Bang. We don't need God for morality. We can be moral. We can be decent people without reference to God. So it's humanism, but it's very secular. There is no religion. There's no scripture behind it. Humanists are focused on the here and now rather than the eternal. There is no eternal life. We have whatever 70, 80, 90 years here, and we have to use our years, use our time to do good and to better the world, make it better, you know, after we are gone than how we found it. And so we have to try to do our best. We have to live an ethical life of personal fulfillment and aspire to the greater good of all humanity without any reference or reliance upon God, Scripture, or religion. We can show mutual care and concern for others without religion telling us to do so. We can strive to create a world without violence, poverty, or brutality. We can work for peace, justice, and opportunity for all. We can cooperate together so that we can all share in the good life. Humans alone, without reference to God, are responsible to make this a better place. All those organizations, all those agencies out there in the world who are trying to make the world a better place, but who also deny Christianity, deny God, deny scriptures, they all might be lumped together in the category of secular humanism. And that essentially, what I've given you there is kind of a condensation of the Humanist Manifesto. Essentially saying we can be good, we can be moral, we can help the world, but we don't need any reference to God. We don't need God or the scriptures to do that. Everything now is based on science and reason. We're not taking our cues from revelation. We don't believe in God. We don't believe in the Bible. Knowledge is based on observation, experimentation, and rational analysis. Science then determines meaning and value. And human reason is the highest standard of judgment. Well, what are the main errors of secular humanism? Well, obviously, like atheism, they deny the existence of God and the truth of the Bible. So it is a contradictory worldview. Now, we certainly agree with the humanists that we should strive to make the world a better place. I think Christians generally do. They are successful in making the world a better place, just like the humanists are trying to do. We all want peace and security. We all want to end poverty and violence and abuse. We want everyone to enjoy a good life. We are striving for the greater good in a certain way. But how do you define a greater good without reference to God or Scripture? Why are concepts like freedom, compassion, or peace good? How do you define the greater good when you have no absolute standard of reference to go by? You know, for many tribes throughout history, the greater good was murdering and eating your opponents. For many thousands of years, different tribes thought that that was a very good thing to do. Let's go and raid the neighboring tribe, kill them all, as many as we can, and eat them if we're able to do that. That was considered the greater good. So loving your family and friends and hating your enemies has been the norm for millennia of human, if you want to call it civilization, for humans. I mean, that's been the standard for many thousands of years and for many people. Under atheistic evolution, peace and security are not virtues and values. Remember, all this is based, again, on science without reference to God, so all we have to explain everything is evolution. And how did everything develop through evolution? Well, through death and mayhem and torture and abuse. You know, the fittest survive, the strongest survive. And so the idea of peace and security is not an evolutionary atheistic idea. Violence, not peace, and security is natural. Murder, mayhem, torture, and death are natural to the animal world. Somebody said that nature is red in tooth and claw. That's natural. That is the way that nature operates. So to say that we want peace and security and everybody enjoying life, That's not how evolution works, and that's what the secular humanist says is how we got here. So all this language about the greater good, ethics, fulfillment, compassion, ideals, value, worth, dignity, freedom, purpose, love, care, concern, justice, opportunity, improvement, beauty, civil rights, where does that all come from? It doesn't spring naturally out of secular humanism. It doesn't spring naturally out of godless evolution. Where did all those ideas come from? They come from a book called the Bible. These are Judeo-Christian ethics. And you see, what the humanist wants to do is retain some of these ideas about the common good and love and kindness and charity. They want to retain those ideas, but they want to get rid of the foundation of those ideas. The foundation of those ideas is God, His Word, His ethics. So they like some of the ethics of Christianity, but they want to get rid of Christianity. Well, you really can't do that. They have no right. You might say they have no right to the furniture. The furniture is what Christianity has provided over the years. They want to get rid of Christianity, and they want to retain the furniture. Well, they have no right to the furniture. They have no right to any kind of moral standards whatsoever, because under atheistic, secular humanism, all they have is, you know, what's popular at the time, and that varies from time to time. And like I said, over the years, over the millennia, killing and eating one another has been much more common than peace and security. So all the universe, remember, is pitiless indifference. There's no good, no evil, no right and wrong under secular humanism. And we could go on to say, as some do today, that it's highly arrogant and bigoted to assume that human flourishing is the greatest good. Now remember, these are humanists, so they want human flourishing. But what might some people call that today, the emphasis that we want humans to do best? They might call that speciesism. Who are you to say that humanity has the right to prosper and succeed instead of maybe some other species? You know, we all came out of that primordial soup of evolution, right? So we're no better than any of the other animals. So why should we prosper and succeed instead of, let's say, cockroaches or rats? You know, maybe the better thing for the entire universe would be that humans would go extinct. There are some people who say that. The best thing for the world would be the extinction of humanity, and then the world would go back to a more natural state, and the little critters could survive and prosper, and that might be actually a better thing than human prospering. So who's to say that humanism is really the better state of things? You see, without any kind of absolute standard, there's no way to say that the human species is any better than any other. So humanism is a threat to the church because it shares some of the goals and some of the claims of Christianity, but really it denies the reality of the Christian religion. It's a worldview that contradicts the main claims of Christianity. Let's go on then to look at pluralism. Plural, as you know, means more than one. And so religious pluralism is to say that all religions basically are the same, or all religions are valid. Pluralism is a effort to validate all the different religions and basically say they're all pretty much the same. Sometimes pluralists describe the different religions as different mountain climbers climbing up the same mountain. Have you heard that idea before? You've got one over here, one over there, one over there, one over there. They really can't see each other. They don't recognize that each other's on the mountain, but they're all climbing the mountain, and they're all going to get there to the top eventually. So the idea is, whether you call it Christianity or Islam or Judaism or Hinduism or Buddhism, these are all kind of basically the same. They're all striving for the same goals. They all have sort of a basic morality that they all have in common. And so it really doesn't matter then. You know, you call yourself a Hindu, I call myself a Christian. That's okay. You know, let's not get hung up on our differences, because in reality, all the religions are pretty much the same anyhow. So here's what one writer says about that. Pluralism occurs when people without strong doctrinal commitments take on highly diverse and even incompatible ideas and fuse them in some way, or they take on highly diverse and contradictory ideas without fusing them, simply letting them stand in spite of their inherent contradictions. So you've got these contradictory religions, and some would try to put them together and say that, well, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, they all share these common characteristics, and so they're all kind of the same. Others would say, no, we recognize the contradictions, but that's okay. Who cares about contradictions? We can maintain the validity of these different contradictory beliefs, even though they contradict. Why would we stand against pluralism? Well, again, it contradicts the Bible. Isaiah 45 verse 6 says, I am the Lord and there is no other. So if you've got a religion that says that there is some other God or that the God of the Bible does not exist, you've got a real contradiction. Or Isaiah 46 9, I am God and there is none like me. So the claims of the Bible are very exclusive. Pluralism asserts that all religions are valid and it's wrong to claim that any one particular belief system is right and the other is wrong. The only real absolute of pluralism is that there are no absolutes or that all religions are valid. I mean, that's the one absolute of pluralism, that is that all religions are valid. And so if all religions are valid, then you really can't criticize any other religion. You can't say, well, that's false. You can't say, well, Buddhism is false, or Hinduism is false, or even, you know, Mormonism is false. No, they're all basically the same. We really can't criticize any of the others. Sometimes you hear this, I've heard this, I don't know how many times, typically on a TV, like a news program, or they're interviewing somebody, and the interviewer will say, are you telling me that all these other religions are wrong, and only Christianity is right? Islam is wrong, and Judaism is wrong, and Hindus are wrong, and Buddhists are wrong. You're telling me that the only means of salvation is through Jesus? Doesn't that condemn about three-quarters of the world to hell? Well, if your friend told you that or asked you that question, are you telling me that there's no other means of salvation other than through Jesus Christ? Would you say, well, I'm really not saying that. There must be a back door. There must be some other way. But what does the Bible say about that? Are we ashamed of those exclusive claims? Didn't Jesus say something about being the way, the truth, and the life? And then what did he say? No man comes unto the Father but by me, except by me. Or Acts 4:12, neither is there salvation in any other, for there's none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. No other means, no other name. So yes, we are making the exclusive statement, the exclusive claim that salvation is in no other name. There's no other means. There's no other way. There's not a back door. Unfortunately, there are some Christians who really soft pedal this idea and really backtrack on it. And they maybe say, well, maybe after death, maybe you'll have one more opportunity after death to hear the gospel and to accept it. Or they might say, well, you know, as long as a person is sincere, you know, you're a Buddhist or you're a Hindu, but you're really sincerely seeking after God, certainly God would let a person like that in. Especially if you're a moral individual, you know, you're not breaking all the Ten Commandments all the time. You're trying to live a morally decent lifestyle. And so you believe in the God that you know. You know, you were raised with these sets of gods under Hinduism or something, and that's what you've been told, and you've been trying to live a decent life, trying to follow those gods, trying to follow the things that you've been taught, and so you didn't know any better, and so God will accept you. Well, biblically speaking, you have no basis to say that. Biblically, the only means of salvation is through Christ, and that's one of the reasons we have to encourage and support missions, right? Why do we go to the four corners of the world if all those religions are good to go anyway? If they're all saved, if they're going to be saved through their gods, why in the world would we spend so much time and effort and money to reach people with the gospel if they're going to be okay anyhow? So it really undercuts the whole Christian mission. So it contradicts the Bible, but it also contradicts or violates the laws of logic. To say the contradictory statements that we have from the different religions are true or valid in the same sense and at the same time. There's a law of logic called the law of non-contradiction. You can't say that two contradictory statements are true at the same time and in the same sense. Either one is wrong and the other is right, or the other is right and the other is wrong, or they're both wrong, but they can't be both right when they make contradictory statements. For example, the Bible says there's one God, and Jesus or God says there's none like me. I am God, there is none other. How many gods are there under the Hindu system? Millions. I think there's over 100 million gods under the Hindu system. Okay, well, either there's one God or there's millions of them. You can't have both. You can't have contradictory statements, both being true at the same time and in the same sense. So pluralism really denies that idea. It validates contradiction. And that eliminates logic. If you're not thinking logically, you really can't have any kind of sense at all. So we disbelieve in pluralism not only because it violates scriptures, but also because it violates logic itself. Let's talk then about the last ism here, postmodernism. What in the world is postmodernism? Well, the main claim, the main problem with postmodernism is that under that system, all knowledge basically boils down to personal opinion. You don't really know the facts for sure. All you know is your feelings about what you've experienced. We can never understand the objective truth of anything. We don't really know the facts. All we really know is how we feel. When I say objective, I mean in black and white terms, not dependent upon how I feel. 2 plus 2, for example, equals 4 objectively. It doesn't matter how I feel about it. The existence of you people in these chairs in this building is an objective fact. It has nothing to do with how I feel about it. It has nothing to do with whether I exist or not. These things are objective facts that anybody could test and approve whether or not you feel a certain way about it or not. Well, postmodernism claims that all you really know is how you feel about your experiences. Postmodernists claim that because we all interpret everything through our own set of biases and filters, we can't know anything objectively or factually because we are biased. I am a white male of European extraction. I happen to be Swedish and Danish. So as a white male of European extraction, I sense the world in a certain way. If I were a black woman of African extraction, my sense or my understanding of the world would be entirely different. So everything goes through our biases, everything goes through our set of filters, and so we can't really know anything with certainty outside of ourselves. All I really know is how I feel. All I really know about these red chairs or you people out there is how I feel about you. I know my own sensations, but my sensations of you people is all biased. It's all through filters. It's all through my own personal experiences. So I don't really know anything other than how I feel about my own personal experiences. That's pretty much postmodernism. And since we can't know the truth or facts objectively, we can't know that anything is right or wrong. Because again, all I know is my experience. All I know is my feelings about things. So if you say that you know the truth, if you say that you know something for sure, well, you're just a bigot. If you say that something is wrong or evil, well, you're just a hater. Because you have no right to say that, because all you know of the world is just your own personal feelings. Now, why is this called postmodernism? Well, whether you knew it or not, previously to about the 1980s, we lived in what people often called the modern world, the modern age of science and rationalism. People believed that objective knowledge was possible. We could know things for sure. We could be certain about this world. We could use the scientific method. All of us have studied the scientific method, and we can weigh things, we can look at things, we can examine things, we can test and prove. We can come to the facts. We can understand our world because we have the scientific method. The human mind can uncover the facts and understand things as they are. Now, Christians believe that we can understand the facts. Well, why do we believe that? Why do we believe that we have access to the facts, to the actual world, and not simply our own feelings? Well, we are made in God's image. God made us rational creatures, which reflect the image of God. And so we can know God. God made us to know Him, to live in fellowship with Him. And God made us to understand the world as it's been made. So we believe that we have access to the facts, that we can understand the world, because we're made in the image of God. Unbelievers, modernists, modernists, believe that they could do that because they are the products of evolution. And as Homo sapiens, they developed, through the evolutionary process, the ability to understand the facts, to look at the world, to examine it, to test it, to use the scientific method to find out the facts. So that was all true, especially after the Enlightenment and up until about the 1980s. And then a few writers, a few so-called scholars came along and started denying all those things, the idea that you could know anything for certain. Modernism has, since about the 1980s, given way to postmodernism. All that modernist certainty is now gone. We don't know anything for sure other than the fact that we are unsure. That's the one certainty in our world today. I'm not sure. That's the only thing that you can state categorically that is certain, and that is uncertainty. Now, there are still many modernists left in the world. When you're looking at a news program or a documentary, and it says the universe is 13.8 billion years old, and the distance from the Earth to the Sun is whatever it is, 93 million miles, and when they say any measurements or any supposed factual things, well, they're relying on a modernist idea that you can know these things for sure. But that's kind of passé right now, and that's moving off the scene. More people are moving toward this uncertainty that nobody knows anything truly for sure. The Western world is slowly turning away from modernist certainty and embracing postmodernist uncertainty. Now, why is that a problem? Why is that a threat? Well, there are many reasons, but I want to illustrate at least one part of this by looking at an illustration, I guess, or a thing that I read in this book. D.A. Carson wrote a book called The Gagging of God that is all about pluralism and postmodernism. And see if you see the problem here as I read this little account. Pluralism, or you could say postmodernism, has sapped the faith of many students and introduced a raft of new challenges to those interested in evangelizing them. Okay, now here's the thing here. Thus, Miss Christian, this is just a generic Christian girl, Miss Christian goes off to the local state university full of zeal and the knowledge of a few fundamental truths. There she will not find lecturers who will devote much time to overturning her truths. Rather, she will find many lecturers convincing her that the meaning of her religion, as in all religion, is merely a communal bias and therefore relative subjective. No religion can make valid claims of a transcendent nature. Truth, whatever it is, does not reside in an object or an idea or a statement or an affirmation about reality, history, or otherwise. Nothing can be known by finite human beings. Rather, it consists of fallible, faulty opinions held by finite knowers who themselves look at things a certain way only because they belong to a certain section of society. Miss Christian is told, a trifle condescendingly, that if her religion helps her, she should be grateful, but that no intelligent person could possibly believe that her beliefs have transcendent claims on everybody everywhere. Thus, without overtly denying her faith, Miss Christian discovers that its vitality has been sapped. It has been relativized, trivialized, marginalized. Without ever having a single one of its major teachings overturned by historical or other arguments, the whole edifice of the Christian truth has been detached from the objective status it once held. Miss Christian drifts off, and it may take years before she thinks seriously about Jesus again, if she ever does. That was a long statement. I don't know if you understood all of that, but the idea is that, as he said, it detaches reality, Christian truth, from reality. It basically says, well, that's your opinion, but that's all it is. And you have no basis, you have no reason to think of it as reality. If you want to think about it, if it helps you, that's fine. But in reality, there is no truth that you can know because we are all the product of our own assumptions. So that's why it's such a threat to us, is that it doesn't just take away the foundations, it removes the whole idea that we can know anything for sure. And so this is where oftentimes today you'll hear people saying, here's how I feel about things, here's my experience, or oftentimes what people say is my truth. Have you heard people saying that? Oftentimes, well, this is my truth, as if I have my own little personal truth and it doesn't matter what the truth is. There's no objective standing of truth. There's just how I feel about things. And who are you then to deny my truth? You know, you just have your opinions, I have my opinions, and everybody's on their own. So there's no objective standard to go by. There's no thus saith the Lord. And if there's no thus saith the Lord, then who has to step in with the authority? The government. You know, if everybody can't control themselves by following a standard of behavior, then the government has to come down pretty hard and heavy because everybody's, like it says in Judges, everybody does what is right in his own eyes. And so that's why we have to have so much government regulation. It should be obvious that as Christians, we cannot embrace the claims of modernism or the claims of postmodernism. Christianity is really pre-modern. Christianity is not based on science and human rationality. Christian certainly not based on the idea that everything is uncertain. Christianity is pre-modern. It goes back to the idea that God exists and God has spoken. And it's a revealed religion. We come to Christianity through the Word of God. God exists and He has spoken. And as Jesus has said, we know the truth and the truth can set us free. The preaching of the cross may be foolishness to the modern or postmodern world, but it's still the truth. It still has the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. We could go on and talk a little bit about morality under postmodernism, just like under atheism. There is no sense of morality because everything is simply your opinion. Years ago when I was going through school, I was working as a short order chef at a truck stop. And I remember one of the young kids that I was working with saying, there's no sure things in this world. Something like that. Well, there's just nothing for sure in this world. And I said to him, are you sure about that? And he stopped and considered for a moment and he said, no. And then I said, are you sure about that? Well, obviously when you start saying there are no sure things, if you really believe that, you wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. You wouldn't put one foot in front of the other. You wouldn't say anything. You wouldn't go anywhere. You wouldn't do anything if you really believed everything was uncertain and unknowable. In fact, one of the self-defeating aspects of postmodernism is they say very strictly and very certainly that you can't be sure of anything. They say with certainty that you can't be certain. Well, if you can't be certain of anything, then you can't be certain of what they're saying, right? It's a self-defeating argument. So it's funny that people like this actually write books or write articles because they are saying, essentially, don't believe what I'm saying. You can't believe what I'm saying. Really what they're saying is you can't believe anything other than what I'm saying. You can believe me, but don't believe anybody else. Well, that's a self-defeating and illogical argument, and it's ridiculous. I hope you can see that. Well, the church is surrounded by challenging ideas like secularism, secular humanism, atheism, pluralism, and postmodernism. None of these ideas is compatible with Christianity, but unfortunately all of them are deeply rooted in our culture today. If the Bible is true, then all these isms are false. If any of these isms are true, then the Bible is false. And obviously we have much greater reason to believe the Bible than we do these other isms. All of these are threats against the church because as our world becomes more atheistic, secular, pluralistic, and postmodern, it will tolerate the Christian point of view less and less. And I hope that you've discerned that in our culture, that the Christian point of view is more and more marginalized. It's more pushed to the side. It used to be for 1,500 years of Western civilization, Christianity was the mainstream opinion. Christianity was the leading factor within Western society, but now more and more it's being pushed to the edges. And it's only a matter of time before our viewpoint will no longer be tolerable within our society. You know, the big watchword is toleration. We got to tolerate everybody other than those who disagree with us. So as long as you keep up with the culture, as long as you do what everybody expects you to do, you'll be fine. But if you stop and say, no, this is unbiblical, this is not right. If you say, no, I'm not going to bake your cake and I'm not going to take your photographs and I'm not going to do your flowers for your so-called wedding, you're going to stand against the culture, you're going to get in trouble. And right now, you know, there may be some ramifications, some negative things, but eventually, if we stand against the culture like that, they may lock us up. Unless things change, these ideas will not only threaten the church, but they threaten to exterminate the church where these ideas prevail. Now, we know that God has said the gates of hell will not stand against the church. We're not worried that the church is going to be exterminated around the whole world. Somewhere in the world, the church will exist at all times until the Lord returns. But if these ideas and these other isms, these other threats to the church, if they continue in our country, it may very well either exterminate the church or force it to go underground. Now, that's not necessarily the worst thing that could happen. Typically, under persecution, the church grows. You've maybe heard the statement, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. Persecution may introduce a great revival in our land. We don't know. But if things keep on going the way they are, and if these isms continue to be very strong and very influential in our land, it will have a radical impact on the church. And that's why the church must push back against these ideas. That's why it's important that we understand what's going on in our world today. The world is changing because it has adopted these ideas and rejected Christianity. Ideas have consequences, and the consequences may be very bad for people like us. As Christians, it's our responsibility to assert biblical truth as well as expose the errors of atheism, secular humanism, pluralism, and postmodernism, along with a lot of the other isms that are threatening the church today. Well, let's close in prayer.